What are people up to in town? Find out on Out There Wednesday afternoon
every
Friday.
Valley Free Radio
for live encounters from the streets and paths of Northampton and beyond.
We don't care if we live a lot of things. We don't care if we're a little bit late. Gonna make a stand between me and you on my rocking bicycle that's built for two.
All right, listeners, I think I kind of botched that one. This is your host, Ruthie Woodring, here for Out There, live in the studio. Today is Friday, 4 o'clock, May 27th, 2022. Out There was on hiatus since, I don't know, like October or November of last year of 2021. And this is my first day back. Once upon a time, Out There was at Wednesday afternoons, so then it was Tuesday afternoons, and now it's Friday. Fridays from 4 to 5, and I expect to be on the air until the fall, I think, for 2 days show. Well, I'm a little rusty here in the studio since, like I said, I haven't been here in the fall, and I got to make sure I get all the buttons pressed. Even when I was on top of my game, getting all the buttons pressed at the right time wasn't my strength, but here we go. So for today's show, I got clips from Kalia, who I ran in today at Cans for Cancer, talking about living at the campground in South Deerfield. I have an interview with a former college professor of mine in Virginia that I stopped and visited on my travels. Actually, when was it? Tuesday. That conversation is just from a few days ago on my way back from Kentucky. Maybe a clip from the kids that I ride bikes with in Kentucky. Maybe an interview with my sister-in-law's sister about direct care, who's a doctor, about direct care and the direct care model where you sort of bypass the insurance companies to get medical care. And maybe an interview with my niece's cousin, who's in ninth grade, about running cross country and track team. All right. To start, though, I guess I got to give a little bit more information about Out There for new listeners, since this is a new time slot. Out There is, well, I call it a community interest show. So I just talk to people that I see out and about around town in my travels, etc. Normally I'm in Northampton here. Yeah, if you're listening, if you're live streaming valleyfreeradio.org, this is here, Northampton, Massachusetts, Florence, Massachusetts, actually, where I live. So normally I'm riding my bike around here picking up trash for pedal people. And but then I go to Kentucky, my homeland, quite often. So I have some clips from that last trip. I was gone for the last 3 weeks of May, just doing family stuff. So now that I'm back in Massachusetts, I just want to start talking today about observing things. Like, what have you observed? This is such an exciting time, springtime in New England with everything popping. I really noticed the black locust flowers on the black locust trees. I love black locust, the way that it smells. They're, you might see them on the bike path or in any disturbed area. The trees are pretty erect, and the flowers have these white clusters. It's a legume. It's edible, so it looks kind of like pea flowers, and they smell so good. And right now, there's lots of the white petals all over the road, like on the sides of the road, washing into the ditches. Another favorite thing I've been noticing today as I've been riding around is blackberry blossoms. The blackberries are also in bloom on the bike path, like on Route 10. On the way to Valley Recycling, there's a incline slope there with blackberries blooming. When they're blooming, it's a real good time to notice, because notice where they're blooming now in May, and then you'll know where to check back in July for the berries, because sometimes it's easier to see the blooms, the blossoms, than the berries, because by the time July comes on some of these slopes, the plants will be covered over with grapevines and other weeds, purple loosestrife on that slope, I think, and other things like that. So take note of where the blackberries are blooming now, so you can come back later. Also, I've been noticing black walnut blossoms. I'd never noticed them before this year, but they hang down on the tips of the black walnut trees. There'll be like, I don't know, three or four that'll hang down and maybe a 2 or 3 inch, I don't know if drupal is the right word, but it's kind of like a string with things hanging off of it that's 2 or 3 inches long. And somehow that thing that's 2 or 3 inches long with all these tiny little flowery things and pollen things, somehow that turns into a round nut. And I'm a bit mystified about how that happens. So I've been trying to look at black walnut trees in different stages. Like, I just came up from the south, so the trees there are a little bit ahead of the trees here. But if you get a chance to watch those black walnut blossoms form, you can see how a 2-inch long string of polleny blossoms turns into a round nut. Very intriguing. A little musical interlude, and then I'll come to the next thing. Next out there, I have an interview with Kalia, who I ran into at Cancer Cancer today, though I think I say that in the interview. It's Friday, May 27th, 2022. I'm here at Cancer Cancer out at Valley Recycling. Cancer Cancer is still going. Here with Dwayne Rainey. And I ran into my friend Kalia. Kalia's been on the show before. We got to talking. Hi, Kalia.
Hello, Ruthie.
What you doing?
Counting cans.
Oh, sorry, I just interrupted your count. How many you got?
25. I know where I'm at.
25. All right. How many are you counting to?
15.
You got a minute I can ask you? We were talking before. How's it? You're living in South Deerfield now?
Yeah, I live in South Deerfield at a campground.
What's it like there?
My boyfriend. Well, it's like living in the country living, you know. Everything takes a long time to, like, clean the tent out or to do laundry. Everything takes a long time. Uh-huh. Because I live in South Deerfield, which is far from everywhere, it seems.
How do you get around?
Well, I have a vehicle, so I can transport myself.
How long have you been at the campground? How long do you think you'll be there?
I've been there about a month, and I'm not sure how long I'm going to be there. Maybe the season,
yes.
Because it's been so hard to get an apartment,
yeah.
Even though I have an income and my boyfriend has an income. It's really hard to get an apartment if you have bad credit. And we both have bad credit.
What are people supposed to do if they have bad credit?
Well, you gotta get people to, what do you call it, co-sign you, or if you have someone that they could vouch for you, you put their name down and say that they're your references, your financial references or personal references. The more references you have, especially financial reference, the better it is that you can get an apartment. And then you have to have money that you can pay down double. Because instead of paying like one extra month, you would have to be able to pay 2 extra months to prove that you'd be able to obtain this rent.
How much is it, if you don't mind me asking, at the campground?
$750
a month. For a tent site?
Just for a tent site spot.
What?
It comes with water, electricity, and a bathroom. So that's it.
Is it available year-round or is it seasonal?
It's only seasonal, and we're here for the season.
Yeah.
Until October.
So are there other places? So what's hard about being at the campground?
Let's see. Being so far away from everyone and everything is pretty hard. Having to do dishes in the bathroom because the water's not on at the campsite, that's pretty hard.
Where do you like to go during the day?
During the day, I go to the gym. I work out for like 2 hours mm-hmm. every day, mm-hmm. if I can.
Yeah. What are your favorite things about being at the campground?
Do I have anything favorite? I don't think so.
You said it's like country living. And there are any good things about it being like country living?
Well, it's quiet and it's calm. I love that. But I'm worried about ticks.
Sorry, this is kind of the worst spot to be.
I'm worried about ticks and mosquitoes because they bite me a lot. They like my blood, it seems.
Consider it a compliment, I guess.
A compliment from nature?
Yeah. Anything else you want to say?
Well, I miss you on your trip, and I want to know more about your travels.
All right.
And I want to go bike riding with you when you have a day off.
Yeah, all right, cool. Yeah, we definitely got to go bike riding. Well, thanks for sharing.
Yeah.
All right, that's my friend Kalia at Cans for Cancers down at Valley Recycling, where Dwayne is collecting deposits. If you've got anything with a 5-cent deposit on it, though he prefers the lightweight aluminum cans and plastic bottles to glass. Glass is heavy and kind of loud, as you heard there. But yeah, if you have redeemables, you can bring them, drop them off anytime Valley Recycling is open. And Dwayne has a little setup there between the scrap metal dumpster. Oh, scrap metal. That's where they put bikes. Between the scrap metal dumpster and the cans and bottles dumpster. And yeah, if you want to donate them to a good cause, Dwayne will redeem them and put some money towards the Cancer Connection and employing the people there that count cans. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. So in that clip with Kalia asked to hear something about my trip to Kentucky. So I'll tell a little bit about my way down there. So I took the Amtrak to Roanoke, Virginia. I took it from Northampton all the way to Roanoke. It's a real sweet ride. Roanoke is the end of the Amtrak line in that direction, in that like southeast direction. I mean, they go south towards, you know, like Richmond and south of there. But if you're trying to get to, say, Tennessee, Roanoke is about as close as you can get coming from the northeast. So I was taking the train there, and then in Roanoke, I switched to the Greyhound down to Knoxville, and then from Knoxville, it's another 85 miles to my parents' place, but I have a bicycle stashed at a friend's house in Knoxville, so I knew I could bike the last 85 miles. But getting to Roanoke, well, the train got in at 11 o'clock at night, and the bus wasn't scheduled to leave till noon the next day. But it was May, and I brought a sleeping bag, and I looked on Google Maps for places close to town where I thought I could tuck myself in unnoticed. But I was very lucky because that night, as I was heading into Roanoke on the train, I finally got to talking to the person across the aisle from me. She was a nun headed to the convent in Roanoke, and she invited me to stay in the convent with her and the other nuns. And so I did. It was very nice. I had a room and had breakfast and prayer with them the next morning. They were super friendly and hospitable. And then, so then the next day I went to catch the bus, but apparently the entire bus station block in Roanoke, which hosted both the Greyhound bus and the city buses, has been bought by a private developer. And so when I went to get the bus, it was just all taped off because of construction. There was no signs. I couldn't even get to where the doorway to the bus station used to be because of the construction. So I asked a shopkeeper across the street where the Greyhound station was, and he said, oh, it's like three or four blocks up that way. And so I went up that way, three or four blocks. And it was basically just a big parking lot with some cones and tape set up for the city buses. And the city buses were, you know, lining up and pulling through. But there wasn't really any signage. I didn't see any Greyhound signage whatsoever. And so I asked like four or five people because I really wanted to be in the right place and catch that bus because there's only one or maybe two buses a day going on that route. And so, and yeah, so there was like nowhere to get out of the sun or the rain or the weather. No bathrooms, no water, no Wi-Fi. Wi-Fi is important on Greyhound because if you have an e-ticket, they don't allow you to pull up the e-ticket on your phone until 2 hours before departure. So if you don't have Wi-Fi, I guess people... Well, see, I don't have a cell phone is the thing. I don't have cell service. So if you don't have that and you don't have a bus station where you can get Wi-Fi, then like you can't even look up your ticket and there's no agent to talk to. But my situation was actually pretty fine compared to the situations of other people that came through looking for the bus. That place when I was there, for example, this guy showed up who said he had actually been there since Thursday. And this was a Tuesday when I was there. He was coming from the other direction. He was coming from Texas. He said he had just gotten out of 17 years in prison in Texas. He just got released like the previous Wednesday. His mother had died 3 weeks earlier before he got released. She died of COVID, I think he said. And so he was heading home to Richmond, but the bus made a layover in Roanoke. He said when the bus driver stopped, the driver said they had an hour and a half layover. So he went to get something to eat and he came back 45 minutes later and the bus was gone. And, you know, he just got out of jail, so he didn't have a sleeping bag or many personal items or, you know, a lot of cash or that kind of thing. He was able to get a phone, like the cheapest phone he could get. So at least he was able to make phone calls and that kind of thing. He said he'd been all around Roanoke asking social service agencies and stuff for a ticket or how to get a bus ticket. Without even a bus station, like you're really stranded in a situation like that. So I told him I'd get him a ticket online, but I had to go like two blocks away to City Hall to get Wi-Fi. And so I was like, all right, you can see from here two blocks away, right? Because it was a construction zone. There weren't buildings in the way. I was like, I'll go get that ticket. But if the bus comes when I'm over there, you don't let that bus leave without me. And then the bus ended up being four hours late. Anyway, so eventually we got in the bus. And then, there was someone else on the bus that looked like they were from another country and talked they're from another country. And they went up to the bus driver and they said, "Bus driver, how many more stops till mine?" And the bus driver said, "Well, I don't know where you're going." And she said, "Texas." And the bus driver's like, "Lady, you have a long ways to go." Because that's like, it was another 29 hours to where her stop was. And she asked me, she was like, "Isn't there a quicker way to go? Like, isn't there like an express train? Or can I take an aircraft? Or like, did I have to take this route on the bus? Isn't there a more direct route?" And I'm like, Texas is a long ways. It's just a long ways. And the buses are slow and there's no express trains. Sorry. And the planes are real expensive from the small towns. But I looked up ticket prices for her for planes and she was like, I think I'll just stick with the bus. Anyway, then like around 10:30 at night, I'm asleep on the bus. I know we're getting close to Knoxville. I'm under my sleeping bag, though, because the trip is just seeming to take forever. So I'm just under my sleeping bag, waiting until we pull into the Knoxville bus station, trying to not be like, are we there yet? Are we there yet? And then I know we're getting close to Knoxville, and then the bus stops sooner, like pretty quickly. You know how if you're like half asleep, you can still, or if you're in a vehicle half asleep, you still know by the movements, you know, when you're coming to where you expect to be. But the bus stopped. It's like it pulled off the interstate and suddenly stopped. And I was And the driver says, this is Knoxville. And I was like, I popped up. I was like, what? No, I've been coming in and out of Knoxville like for years. And I was just there like 6 weeks ago. This isn't Knoxville. This is some gas station on the side of the interstate. And I'm asking other people, is this Knoxville? And people are like, yep. And I asked people outside the bus, well, where's downtown? And I had to ask four or five people before someone knew. And this guy says, oh, it's just right over the hill on the interstate, but I don't know how to get there any other way. And I don't know how far it is, but, you know, it's just over the hill on the interstate. And he offered to give me a ride, which was nice of him. But I had my little kick scooter, so I eventually kick scootered in the dark to my friend's house on the other side of town, where I spent the night on their couch. Their door is always open. It's great. I can come in at 1 in the morning, not tell them I'm coming, and go to sleep on their couch. Anyway, then I got my bike the next day and rode home. That's a whole nother trip, a whole nother story, that trip. I won't go into that. This is supposed to be a radio show. This is out there on Valley Free Radio, and I want to go to the next clip. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. This is WXOJLP 103.3 FM in Northampton. And so my next clip is on my way back from Kentucky. You know, I've been thinking the last month or two or year or decade or a couple decades about an old college professor I had in southwestern Virginia. I'd had him for a women's studies class and a U.S. government 101 class, and I was thinking about how I want to visit him again because he really had a profound impact on my life, and I want him to know that, and just I like him, and I really appreciate who he is and what he's done in the world, so I thought I'm going to try to find him, look him up, and go visit him. So I also got to interview him. That's Steve Fisher from Emory and Henry College. And what else do I want to say about that? It was a bit of transit, somersaults, and gymnastics to visit him, and a combination of 3 a.m. buses and borrowing a bike and carpooling and my scooter in the middle of the night and sleeping in the park, blah, blah, blah. All right, here's Steve.
So I'm here in Emory, Virginia with Dr. Steve Fisher. Dr. Fisher was a professor of mine at Emory and Henry College in 1991, 92, 93, sometime in there. And I attribute him with helping me see the world in a very different way than I had previously. I had him for U.S. Government 101 and Women's Studies. Steve, you'll say hi.
Hey.
How long have you been a professor for?
Well, I came to Emory and Henry in 1971 and took early retirement in 2006 for about 35 years. I'm still a professor, but not in the classroom anymore.
So I was curious, like, what made you, what, is there any, like, events in your life that really changed how you saw the world or your role in it?
Yeah, there have been several, but the major one was... I graduated from Wake Forest in 1966. The war was going on. I was from West Virginia. They were trying to draft everybody they could from West Virginia. The last semester of my senior year, I went for a physical, and even though I had all sorts of different kinds of problems, they passed me, told me I had 30 days to get my affairs in order. Anyway, it was at a time when if you could get to graduate school, you could get a graduate deferment, and so... I ended up going to Tulane down in New Orleans, and then the year, that very year after that, they ended graduate deferments. And so I've been lucky along the way. In order to get in graduate deferment, you needed an 80 on the test, and I got an 82. Mm-hmm. But I didn't have much politics. I was in a traditional political science graduate program in European politics, and was the field that I was in. Yeah, because mainly because my advisor was in that field, and there was this exchange scholarship with the Free University of Berlin, and that he wanted me to apply for, and German was virtually non-existent. I hadn't even finished my master's degree, but he wanted me to do that, And he embarrassed me to do it. And then I thought, well, I'll never get it. So I agreed to do it. And I think three people applied. And the first two got it and turned it down. And so then there it was with me. And again, my advisor embarrassed me, you know, so that I would do it, even though at the it was for dissertation writing, and I didn't have a dissertation topic at the time. And so I came up with one. I was in a political parties course, and I came up with something like the role of minor parties in Germany and the United States, something like that. And so we ended up getting married to somebody that I really hadn't been with very long in June in 68. And then I left and went to a German language institute in Munich. And, you know, again, I was just sort of a very weak liberal. I mean, I knew that more sort of was wrong, but if they got me, I would have gone, I guess. So my wife joined me, and we took the train to Berlin from Munich. Of course, Berlin at the time was part of East Germany. And so we stopped at every stop with by East German police coming in and patrolling. And we got to West Berlin, and we settled into an apartment owned by some people from South Africa. And so my wife got a job at the officers' club. Army barracks were right across from the Free University, and so there was constant conflict going on there. Free University was sort of a hotbed of student radicalism, and Berlin was a draft-free city, so all the German radicals would be coming to the Free University. And so I began work on my dissertation, and so I began to sit in these different kinds of political party, I mean, minor party groups, and from communists to the socialists to the right wing, and began doing interviews. But I was over there on my own, basically, because, you know, and my wife was. And so I just began reading in a way that I hadn't read before, and the things I hadn't read before, you know, Malcolm X and all these those kind of books. And it just sort of began to make me question. And then I read Noam Chomsky, who was a key intellectual figure in my life. And one of the essays was Responsibility of Intellectuals. And there's a line in there, Responsibility of Intellectuals to speak the truth and never tell lies. And I began to become more and more, this was, you know, we had Armed Forces Radio, and so you know, it was the 68 convention in Chicago where police came crashing down on students and all sorts of different kinds of things going on. Muhammad Ali came on the scene. I thought he was a loudmouth, and I came back thinking he was a radical. Same thing with Bob Dylan. I thought Dylan's voice was awful. I came back thinking that Dylan was wonderful. But I became more and more radicalized as I began to read more and then began to interpret things. And then I would go out to the officers' club. At night, one night, somebody came up to me and asked me how I was, and then gave me my parents' names and my sister's names. And it turned out he was from the CIA and wanted me to infiltrate these groups and to report back to him. It would be a great patriotic act. I said, well, you're a bit off track, because I go to these meetings of these student radicals, and all they talk about is what Marxist view of certain physics theories are. I said, they're not very activist at all. And he kept pushing, and I refused. And at that point, I knew there was a file on me somewhere in Washington. Mm-hmm. And so the more I read, and the more I saw, and the groups I began to hang out with, I came back a much, much different person. I was really totally, totally radicalized. I was an angry radical because I didn't have any substance underneath it. I just knew that things were wrong and that I had a responsibility to speak the truth and to never tell lies. And so I went to back to Tulane, a much different person. And then they had Kent State, and we got involved with leading protests on the Tulane campus, And so that was a turning point in my life politically, is that I then knew that I would not go to the war if they got me. Then eventually the lottery came, and I got a high number. So I've been a very fortunate person in terms of all of that. And then I became much more active in New Orleans and got involved in some race stuff and some other kinds of things. And so when I arrived at Emory, I took it because it was the only job I could get. And I did not because I wanted to come back to Appalachia, which is where I was from. And I was ashamed to be an Appalachian. I carried that. That's what the first thing I learned at Wake Forest was that I was a hillbilly and that I should be ashamed. And so I carried that shame with me the whole time. And then my second semester at Emory, there was a student-run symposium on Appalachia. And people like, these things won't mean anything to folks, but Helen Lewis and other people who were beginning to form Appalachian studies spoke. And I was transformed by that. It's the first time I'd ever heard anybody speak proudly of being from Appalachia. And so I began to develop courses around that and move away from the European government courses and eventually became, fully involved in Appalachian studies, which led to a whole host of life changes for me. So that experience in Berlin, being on my own and being able to do the kind of reading and free thinking that experience gave me, and then my experience with different kinds of groups, was a key, the first radicalizing experience in my life.
There's so many directions we could go, but I want to ask you about what Appalachian identity means to you.
Well, it means different things to different people, but Appalachian, it means working for change in the region. The most popular course I taught at Emory, and the one that students constantly refer to, was the Appalachian course. I developed an Appalachian politics course. And we spent a lot of time on issues of identity and getting students. I was teaching a lot of first-generation college kids from Southwest Virginia and in the mountains, who also had come probably ashamed. And so we began to talk about what it meant to be from Appalachia. People define it for themselves, in a sense. But it means having some pride in that area, but also working to make change in the area. Helped start and got involved in a number of organizations and did a lot of writing about the region, and then got involved in a number of different causes, including the Pitsna strike, which was a major deal in the region. And
can you talk about that?
Well, I was known as sort of a radical in Appalachia, and so I connected to the miners. I mean, this was a life or death battle for the union. And Jesse Jackson came down to speak. There was something called Camp Solidarity, and Cecil Roberts was the vice president. He was talking about a class war, and then they would blockade different coal trucks and stuff. And they made a general call out to people in support of the union to come to St. Paul, Virginia, and take part in a massive civil disobedience. It could have been 1,000 people there, I don't know. But we would sit down and they would just haul us off, sitting in hot buses for a while, and then taking us down to the National Armory where we were fingerprinted and taken back down to the main center where we could get our cars. But that also was an important experience for me. I remember sitting up in the balcony as the gym, steps of the gym, talking with two other people from West Virginia who were well known in the region. And we all talked about wanting to get back to our home region, home state, but we couldn't do that for various reasons. That was it was something that I felt I had to do. The college could have fired me for that because I didn't follow state law, but for some reason they didn't. But it was the second civil disobedience I'd done. Yeah, that was around Nicaragua. And so my first couple of years at college, I took on every assignment, did everything, because people were convinced that I was this radical and I didn't have any substance. And so I became more and more involved with different issues at school, and eventually at some point helped started a living wage campaign and doing some other things at the college. The starting point for me was Berlin.
So one of the things that I've been doing in Kentucky when I go back these days, there's some neighbor kids that I've been riding bikes with. So we've got a tandem bicycle there. And so this, it's a boy and a girl. Usually, like, the girl rides on the tandem with me and the boy rides his own bike. They're not allowed to ride on the road by themselves because the road's a little dangerous and the kids can be a little unpredictable. But we've had some conversations where the kids have said some really, really overtly racist things. And a lot of outsiders have the stereotype of Appalachia as being a really racist place. Can you speak to that? Like, in what ways do you have stories like to counter that? And what, like, or how racism is all over the country and it expresses itself differently in different places? Yeah, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I live in a county where 80% of my neighbors voted for Trump.
Me too.
and so we've people here feel left down, looked down on, and so when somebody speaks to them in the kind of language that Trump and others did, we're all racist in some form or another, and we have to constantly be aware of that and to fight it. And for the white Appalachian down here, many of them anyway, feel like they have been ridiculed. And also, you know, when Obama was elected president, they felt, you know, that blacks were you know, where were they to get their status? I mean, being white was the last thing they had to claim, you know, some kind of status and identity. And so people need to begin thinking about how we can bring some sense of dignity to people down here, how they can be made to feel like that they are respected, how they can, you know, begin to see that they're getting the kind of aid and stuff that they need. And it's sort of our responsibilities to, I mean, the Democratic Party has failed in so many different ways in terms of dealing with rural areas. And so who's speaking for rural people? And so Trump comes along and, you know, hits this particular chord about that. Rather, because there's nobody else speaking to them. And so the Democratic Party has to figure out ways to, or some other party, ways to speak to rural people in a manner that shows respect and also they can see concrete benefits from it.
That was an interview with Dr. Steve Fisher, activist, author, political science professor emeritus at Emory and Henry College in Emory, Virginia. Not to be confused with Emory University in Atlanta, I believe. Emory and Henry College is a small liberal arts college with about 800 students, I think, or at least it had when I went there. And that interview was in Dr. Fisher's house this past Tuesday, May 24th, 2022, as I was on my way back from Kentucky back up to Massachusetts. He was probably my favorite, most impactful professor ever. He also founded and directed the Appalachian Center for Community Service, which I think is now called the Appalachian Center for Civic Life there on Emory and Henry College campus. And a song. I asked Dr. Fisher for requests. Oh, here's Tracy Chapman. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. And when we come back, I have a clip from the biking kids from Kentucky, the neighbor kids.
Thank you. Oh, my mama told me, 'cause she said she learned the hard way. Say she wanna spare the children. She say don't give a say your soul away, 'cause all that you have is your soul. So don't be tempted by the shiny apple. Don't you eat of a bitter fruit. Hunger only for a taste of justice. Hunger only for a world of truth, 'cause all that you have is your soul. I was a pretty young girl once. I had dreams, I had high hopes. Married a man who stole my heart away. Gave his love, but what a high price to pay. And all that you have is your soul. Don't be tempted by the shiny apple. Don't you eat of a bitter fruit. Hunger only for a taste of justice. Hunger only for a world of truth. 'Cause all that you have is your soul. Why was I such a young fool? Thought I'd make history, making babies was the best I could do. Thought I made something could be mine forever. Another hard way when can't possess another. And all that you have is your soul. Don't be tempted by the shiny apple. Don't you eat of a bitter fruit. Hunger only for a taste of justice. Hunger only for a world of truth. Is all that you have is your soul. I thought I could find a way. Be the system, make a deal and have no debts to pay. Take it all, I take it all, had to run away. Leave myself first class and first rate. But all that you have is your soul. Don't be tempted by the shiny apple. Don't you eat of a bitter fruit. Hunger only for a taste of justice. Hunger only for a world of truth. 'Cause all that you have is your soul. Here I am, I'm waiting for a better day. A second chance, a little luck to come my way. Hope to dream, hope that I can sleep again. Awaken a world with a clear conscience and clean hands. 'Cause all that you have is your soul. Don't be tempted by the shiny apple. Don't you eat of a bitter fruit. Hunger only for a taste of justice. Hunger only for a world of truth. 'Cause all that you have is your soul. Oh, my mama told me, 'cause she said she learned the hard way. Said she wanna spare the children. She say don't give a say your soul away, 'cause all that you have is your soul. All that you have. All that you have. All that you have. It's your soul.
There's been an awful lot of talk about how changing the world, but gonna succeed. We gotta get out the word. I wanna change it with you. I wanna change it with you. There's been an awful lot of simple people feeling left out. Gotta seize the power, throw the fat cats out. I wanna change it with you. I wanna change it with you. If we want to, we can feed the world. If we want to, we can stop the hate. If we want to, we can change the world right now.
Otis Gibbs here on Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP 103.3 FM in Northampton. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Up at 5 o'clock. Dr. Steve Fisher, who I had that last interview with, also has a show on the college radio station at Emory and Henry, WEHC, called Rise Up Singing. All right, next, as promised, this is my biking buddies from Kentucky.
So I'm here. Where are we? The Davisburg Trail. We're on Davisburg Trail.
Yeah.
Right? With Isaac or Little Bill. How do you prefer to be called?
Isaac.
And what's your name?
Mallory.
And Mallory. And we're neighbors. How did we meet? Anyone remember?
We meet, I think you met my brother first, and then you met me, and then you met my family.
Yeah, I met Sebastian because I saw he was
met
working
Tiffany
on bikes.
Too.
And Tiffany, yeah, yeah. Yeah, so where do y'all live?
Under a big old hill.
Yeah.
Brakes, Kentucky.
And where do you go to school?
Brakes School Center.
Do you like it?
Yes.
Yeah.
No.
Yes? No?
No, I don't like school.
Yeah,
no.
I do.
Do you?
Yeah. Yes.
What's your favorite things about it?
PE.
Writing and PE and music.
Yeah, I actually do like
and
school.
And science.
Yeah, and you're on the basketball team, Mallory. Yeah. So, Isaac, when I first met you, we worked on bikes a little bit. How did you get into bicycles? Because... Yeah, how did you get
I rode them since I've been...
Like six?
Six.
Uh-huh.
And started working on them with tools and stuff, gathered up all my tools.
Uh-huh. How about you, Mallory?
When I was like... Well, I was little bitty when he used to do them, when he used to be on bikes.
Uh-huh.
So, maybe when he was like nine, I was six.
Uh-huh.
And rode bike, so I started riding them with him.
Uh-huh.
And if my bike tours up, he fixes them.
Uh-huh. I've seen different members of your family out walking on the road down to the store or wherever, and I always appreciate that because there's not a whole lot of people walking around here or on bikes, except for maybe us. You think you'll keep on riding bikes? Do you think your love for bikes will continue as you get older?
Maybe.
Maybe, yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe. It depends.
What does it depend on?
Maybe if I get a job, get a car, and yeah, that stuff.
How about you, Isaac?
Same.
Yeah.
But go to college first. Go to college all the way through college first.
Mm-hmm.
Then get my driver's license and get a job and then get a car.
Uh-huh. Same for you? What do you think?
Same.
If you had a job and a car, if you still had free time, do you think, like if you were an adult, do you think you would still want to go biking on weekends?
I've got a question.
Yeah.
How long have you been riding bikes?
I think I learned to ride when I was 7. On this banana seat.
Banana seat?
No, it was a banana seat that was red and yellow when I got it. My parents got it from the Sears Roebuck catalog. And then I spray painted it blue for Kentucky and I wrote like UK Wildcats on it, I think.
Do you like Fords or Chevys?
I don't really like cars at all.
You don't?
No.
No, like trucks.
I don't really like trucks either.
How about bicycles?
Oh, I like bikes. Have you always lived here? In Eastern Kentucky?
Yeah.
Do you ever think about living somewhere else?
Nope.
Nope.
No?
Maybe. Depends when I get like 18.
Yeah.
I'm Sulky Martin.
And Sulky is my niece's cousin. So I hear you like to run.
Yeah, I do.
How did you get into running?
Well, in 7th grade, I joined cross country because my brother joined cross country. So I just kind of started there. And then I kept going every year, kept joining cross country. And yeah, that's basically where it started.
So the cross country race is, what, is it 5K? How far is it?
Yeah, it's a 5K.
Yeah. Have your times gotten faster since 7th grade? What grade are you in
now? 9th grade.
Uh-huh. How fast were you when you first started, do you remember?
Well, I remember I would always get like kind of around the middle of the races. Like I would never get like first or anything. I'd always be around the middle. I don't remember my exact times, but yeah.
And now?
Now I usually get like top few people in the races. So, yeah.
Why do you think you got faster but everybody else didn't?
Well, I think, I don't know. I guess, well, I trained harder over the years, I guess. Like, I trained harder summer.
Do you enjoy the competitive aspect of it?
Yeah, I do.
So, when I would run cross country, it would seem to me kind of like, who can endure the most pain? Do you ever feel like that?
Yeah.
where do you find the joy in it?
Well, I guess I find the joy in finally, like, accomplishing your goals, I guess. Like, if you really wanted to get this time or really wanted to beat someone, this person, and then you do it, then you're, like, really happy and it, like, motivates you to make another goal or something.
How do you decide how to train to become faster?
Well, basically, in the off seasons, like, after cross country end or track end, I just have to work on running throughout those off seasons so that I can stay in shape so that when the next season comes around, I can be fast and try to be faster than whoever I'm competing against.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you have a coach that will give you suggestions in the off season, or do you go watch YouTube videos or ask Milka? Or
Well, usually my coach, sometimes he has like a program where you can go like do weightlifting and run a bit, but he'll like suggest to run some miles each week. Like he'll say, oh, I think you should run like 2 miles a day for this week or something. Yeah, usually my coach suggests things.
Do you have any running role models?
Yeah. So there's a girl she was like the fastest girl on our team. Like she has a record for our team. And her name's Kylie O'Dell, but she like graduated like a couple years ago. But she's kind of who I look up to because I want to get to her times one day. Yeah.
Any words of encouragement for people, young people especially, who are considering running?
Well, just don't give up when you're like tired or you're running and you really don't want to run anymore. Like, don't give up, because then after you finish that race or after you finish that practice, then you're just going to keep getting stronger and stronger, and then you're going to be able to like endure that later on, and you'll get faster.
That was my niece's cousin Sulky from Clymer, New York. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. Democracy Now! Comes up at 5 o'clock. Thanks for listening today. Out There is now on every Friday from 4 until 5. And here's Sulky's request. This is Imagine Dragons. Mm-hmm.
up to the sounds of the silence that allows for my mind to run around with my ear up to the ground. I'm searching to behold the stories that I told when my back is to the world that was smiling when I turned. For my fold and the laughter in the holes and the names that I've been called, I stack it in my mind and I'm waiting for the time when I show you what it's like to be worse fit in the mind. Tell you all the greatest, but once you turn to haters, oh the misery, everybody wants to be my enemy.
Okay, I'm hoping that somebody pray for me. I'm praying that somebody hope for me. I'm staying where nobody supposed to be. Posted, being a wreck of emotions. Ready to go whenever you let me know. The road is long, so put the pedal into the flow. The energy on my trail, my energy unavailable. I'ma tell the monster the way go. Hey, when I fly on my drive to the top, I've been out of shape, thinking out of the box, I'm an astronaut. I blasted off the planet, rock that caused catastrophe, and it matters more because I had it. Now I had, I thought about wreaking havoc on an opposition. Kinda shocking, they want a static with precision. I'm automatic, quarterback, I ain't talking sack and pack it up, I don't panic. Batter, batter up, who the baddest? It don't matter, cause we is your
thug. Everybody wants to be my enemy.
I got enough time left for a couple more announcements. This is Out There, the tail end of Out There here on Valley Free Radio. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. So don't forget about the Florence Farmers Market. Today's Friday. Wednesdays from 2 to 6 in downtown Florence. Also, the Saturday Farmers Market is going on in downtown Northampton. I assume the Tuesday evening one, too. But, okay. So this is Out There's new time, Fridays at 4 to 5, which Fridays, another thing that happens on Friday evenings, if you're into it, is Ultimate Frisbee in Haydenville, Fridays at 6. It's a pick-up Ultimate, family-friendly, 6 p.m. Fridays. It's on off of Fairfield Ave, the park off of Fairfield Ave in Haydenville. All right, Democracy Now! Is coming on at 5. Don't forget to smell the flowers and play some which way.
Yo, this is Lady J, and you're listening to Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP, 103.3 FM, Northampton, Massachusetts.